president has engaged in abuse of power, undermining our national security and jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. His actions are in defiance of the vision of our founders and the oath of office that he takes to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Sadly, but with confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi today saying President Trump has left Democrats no choice but to move forward with impeachment. Her announcement makes it increasingly likely that Trump will be impeached before Christmas. And that would make Trump just the third president in American history to be impeached by the House. Well, just before her announcement, Trump said on Twitter that Democrats had, quote, gone crazy. And he said they should get the whole thing over with. Well, joining me now is California Democratic Congresswoman Karen Bass. She's on the Judiciary Committee, which held its hearing on impeachment yesterday. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, did anything you heard yesterday make you think twice about voting to impeach President Trump?
No, absolutely not. I mean, to hear from constitutional scholars who go through the history and explain what the framers meant. What's particularly important to me is the notion of high crimes and misdemeanors. And I think if you think about it in the context of today, that is confusing. Because in our context, you think of somebody robbing a bank or committing a murder. But when the founders, when the framers were writing about it, they were writing about the exact type of behavior that President Trump has exhibited, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, from the beginning of his administration, but most notably with the phone calls with the Ukraine and him attempting to bribe and threaten the president of the Ukraine.
So you think bribery should definitely be one of the articles of impeachment?
No, I am definitely not saying what should an article of impeachment be. We will determine that. And I will tell you that in the meetings that we've had in Judiciary, we have not decided on the number of articles nor what the articles should be.
Okay, so then what does happen next? If you haven't decided on the number or what's in the articles, how do you decide that?
So, well, we will be deciding it next week. I mean, with Speaker Pelosi's press conference and press statement that she made today, we will be having a hearing on Monday. And our hearing on Monday now is going to be to hear the evidence that the Intelligence Committee put forward, and maybe the evidence from the other committees as well. Right now, I just know about intelligence. That's what's going to happen on Monday. So yesterday was, if you will, it was like being in a classroom in college where we heard about our history. We heard about the intent of the framers. Now it's, okay, here's the evidence. Now, then from there, we will determine how many articles and what the articles should focus on.
Well, speaking of evidence, I want to play a clip of tape from the witness the Republicans called, Jonathan Turley,
sure,
of George Washington University, who says you don't have enough evidence, at least not yet.
You're saying Article 1 gives us complete authority that when we demand information from another branch, it must be turned over or we'll impeach you in record time. Now, making that worse is that you have such a short investigation. It's a perfect storm. You set an incredibly short period, demand a huge amount of information, and when the president goes to court, you then impeach him.
Okay, so his argument there is that you might actually have a stronger case if you waited for all of the evidence, for all of the witnesses that you wanted to testify to get court approval to come forward.
I will tell you, the thing that surprised me yesterday was the weakness of the Republican witness, because it's quite ironic to say that when it's the president and it is the administration that is holding back on a trove of information. So, for example, the ambassador to the EU, the guy who, you know, said it was absolutely a quid pro quo, testified based on his memory, because the State Department will not even allow him to look at his notes. And frankly, remember, the president came forward. You can't have better evidence than coming out of the president's mouth himself. He said to the press directly what he had done. He released a transcript that verified what he had done. His chief of staff went before the press and said, yes, this is what we did. this is the way foreign policy has done, and told all of us to get over it. Well, I focus on foreign policy. I serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee. That is not how our foreign policy is done. What the president did was for his own benefit, and to me, the urgency, and one of the other reasons why we cannot wait, is because he is attempting to intervene in the next election. Rudy Giuliani is over in the Ukraine right now. He sent the attorney general around the world. We don't know if he's not still continuing to intervene in the election. So to me, there is an incredible sense of urgency. We must act now. We cannot allow our own president to interfere in the election. It's bad enough we're worried about the Russians interfering. Now we have to worry about our president interfering in the election?
Well, arguably, it's a foregone conclusion that you will vote to impeach, and arguably it's a foregone conclusion that the Senate will not vote to convict.
I don't necessarily agree with that.
Okay.
I think that there is I do agree because the speaker came forward today. Now, yesterday I would have said something to you different, but when our speaker came forward and said that we are going to move forward with impeachment, that's the decision. I don't automatically assume that the Senate is not going to convict. Now, there is a scenario that if three or four senators came forward and all of the Democrats, I'm sorry, three or four Republican senators and all of the Democrats voted for a secret ballot, who knows what will happen? Because the only reason my Republican colleagues will not admit what they very well know that this president has done is because they're all scared to death that he is going to attack them through tweets. I find that just shameful that they would, because of their own individual elections, compromise our election and compromise our democracy and make us look like fools to the world.
But arguably, they're looking at their constituencies. And when you look at polling after the House Intelligence Committee hearings, the needle didn't move much at all. The country is still pretty much split on impeaching the president.
But the fact that the country is split is profound. 50% of the American people believe he should not only be impeached, but he should be tried and convicted and removed. At the height of the Clinton impeachment, there wasn't even 30% of the public that believed it. So I would love for it to be 90%, but the fact that it is 50% is huge. We should not lose sight of that.
Well, what do you see as the eventual outcome? Let's just say, given the current situation right now, that what I said earlier will come to pass, that the Senate will not vote to convict. Then what happens?
I think if that happens, at least I am hoping, and there is no guarantee, that when he goes through the impeachment process, that will help to put the brakes on him from interfering in our next election. Now, the other scenario that could happen is his behavior is so erratic, so unpredictable, that he could very well in the next 2 weeks do something completely bizarre, like pull the troops out of Syria that led to the slaughter of Kurds, that led to ISIS soldiers essentially being released into the world. That was an erratic, crazy decision. And I think when he is backed up against the wall, it's no telling. I mean, right now he's considering sending 14,000 troops to the Middle East. For what? What he does on the international stage is absolutely frightening. And when he gets cornered like this, his behavior might become so erratic that the Republicans decide, which is what I believe, is that he's a clear and present danger and needs to be removed from office. I don't think that we can wait another year, frankly.
All right, let's turn to some other news now. What do you think of Senator Kamala Harris dropping out of the presidential race?
Well, seeing our senator drop out of the race was definitely disheartening to me. I think she had a brilliant run. It was so exciting to see her on the national stage. I thought she did great. But at the end of the day, every campaign has to have a tremendous amount of money. And how difficult is it to run when you have people who are, number one, personally incredibly wealthy, and then number two, have been at it longer than her, and so have the ability to raise the low donors Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. So I was disappointed to see her leave the race, but I will tell you that she has an incredibly bright future, that she broke a glass ceiling in terms of an African-American woman running for president and making a very strong, legitimate run. So her and Shirley Chisholm, they will be in our history records forever.
Right. Well, so what do you make of the fact that she is a Black woman who had to drop out of the race and that she was the only minority candidate to have so far qualified for the next Democratic debate? That if you know, the debate looks like it's going to be a sea of white faces.
Well, I mean, I think that's unfortunate. I don't think it represents the diversity of the Democratic Party. And like I said, I mean, I was saddened to see her leave. Now, there is still time for Cory Booker to qualify, I believe. I don't believe we've hit the deadline yet, for Julian Castro, for Tulsi Gabbard. So I've not given up that there won't be a person of color. I just wish it was our senator.
And are you leaning towards anyone for an endorsement?
Chairing the Congressional Black Caucus, I represent and speak on behalf of 54 members. Sadly, we just lost one of our members when Elijah Cummings passed away. And our members are supporting a variety of different candidates. And so as long as I'm chair, it's really better. The members prefer for me to be neutral.
And why do you think that most African-American voters, at least so far, Democratic, support Joe Biden?
Well, I think that African-American voters know Joe Biden. And I think that very similar to what happened in 08, if you remember, the majority of African-American voters did not support Barack Obama either. That happened after the Iowa caucuses, but it also happened after there were some missteps on behalf of the Clinton campaign. So because African-American voters are supportive now, you know, we will see what happens in the future. You know, people know Joe Biden, and Joe Biden has a great history with African-Americans. And it's not just because he was the vice president with Barack Obama. He has his own independent history with Black voters, and people have known him for decades and they trust him.
All right. L.A. Congresswoman Karen Bass, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Stanford law professor Pamela Karlan took the stand in yesterday's impeachment hearings to share her legal expertise on the process. She did not hold back against Republicans. Here she is with Representative Doug Collins.
And here, Mr. Collins, I would like to say to you, sir, that I read transcripts of every one of the witnesses who appeared in the live hearing because I would not speak about these things without reviewing the facts. So I'm insulted by the suggestion that as a law professor, I don't care about those facts.
But she did backtrack on another comment she made when she mentioned Donald Trump's 13-year-old son, Barron. It began with Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee asking Karlan this question.
What comparisons, Professor Karlan, can we make between kings that the framers were afraid of and the president's conduct today?
So kings could do no wrong because the king's word was law. And contrary to what President Trump has said, Article 2 does not give him the power to do anything he wants. And I'll just give you one example that shows you the difference between him and a king, which is the Constitution says there can be no titles of nobility. So while the president can name his son Barron, he can't make him a baron.
Okay, a little play on words there, but that comment did spark outrage amongst Republicans, both online and at the hearing. With me now to talk about it is Ariane DeVogue. She covers the Supreme Court for CNN. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so this exploded on Twitter. Did it deserve the amount of response that it got?
Well, it's interesting. It was an interesting day because people who are familiar with Pamela Karlan, you know, she's this leading liberal lawyer. She's argued before the Supreme Court. She's really well respected in liberal circles. They knew ahead of time to expect fireworks. That's the kind of woman she is. But she did take by surprise some of these Republicans, right? And they thought that this might be a snoozy constitutional hearing. And, you know, as you said, before the hearing started, she made this strong opening statement. But then her outspokenness, which has been a hallmark of her career, did get herself in trouble there. And if you look at it as a whole, and it certainly has triggered outrage, the First Lady sent out that tweet. She never tweets, not that often. And Carlin's supporters said it was being blown out of proportion. They really appreciate her outspokenness, and they point out that she apologized for the comment she made. But if you look at the hearing as a whole, even without the comment, she wasn't convincing many Republican members there. I mean, she was the Democratic expert who was called. So the hearing itself, I don't think that what she said moved things one way or the other. It's kind of just like you see it maybe on Twitter. The conservatives are outraged. The liberals say that it's being overblown and say that they appreciate her outspokenness. So that's kind of what I felt like at the end of that marathon 8-hour hearing.
Right. Well, give us a little background on her. She's at Stanford, and she apparently was on President Clinton's shortlist to be on the Supreme Court.
Well, to be honest, she's been on shortlists. She certainly was mentioned with Obama, too. But it's interesting because she, as you said, she's a law professor at Stanford. She co-directs their Supreme Court clinic. She briefly served in Obama's Department of Justice. And she, about a decade ago, you can learn a lot about her because she gave this speech to graduating class. And she said, you know, she has regrets in her life. She regretted working too hard. She regrets getting frustrated by little things. But she said she never regrets her dedication to liberal causes or speaking out. And in that speech, she admitted that her candor at times has cost her some things. And there she was alluding to the fact that she is not on the Supreme Court, although she probably was as smart as a lot of the other contenders. But she never made it to the tippy top of the list because she has said in her career a lot of fiery things. She has been provocative. She hasn't held back. And so in that graduation speech a decade ago, she said, would I like to be on the Supreme Court? You bet I would, but not enough to have trimmed my sails for half a lifetime.
So when she was in government, she was working for the Obama administration, right, on voting rights?
Yeah, she is an expert on voting rights issues. She's written about it, so she's worked on that. And she did come here and worked for a brief period of time for the Department of Justice. But really, she spent most of her time in academia working for liberal causes. And she just recently appeared at the Supreme Court.
And she's argued several times before the Supreme Court.
Right.
What was the most recent case?
So the most recent case is one of the biggest cases of the term, and it asks this question: does federal employment law that bans discrimination based on sex include sexual orientation? And she represents LGBT workers, and she thinks that the court should absolutely interpret this law to incorporate LGBT workers. She was just there, I think it was in October, and appeared there. But that's not the first time, it's just the latest.
Right. Is any ambition to be appointed to the federal judiciary below the Supreme Court?
It's difficult to tell. She's now 60 years old, and it brought up something interesting yesterday, because acknowledging sort of this hidden secret that before, at least the Trump administration, if you spoke out, if you weren't considered, quote, mainstream in either conservative or liberal circles, you weren't usually considered for the Supreme Court. And she clearly is not mainstream for some of the things that she said. Maybe at the, you know, it's not really her beliefs, but it's some of the things she's written and that she's said. But on Twitter yesterday, some of the liberals who have now seen what Trump has done to the courts, which has absolutely transformed them and pushed through a lot of nominees that wouldn't be considered quote-unquote mainstream, some of the liberals were like, huh, why didn't we act when we could and put somebody like Pam Carlin on the bench? So it was interesting that that hearing not only triggered sentiments about her comments or about the impeachment, but also brought up this whole idea of who judges should be, who nominees should be, because there would have been a lot of people who would have appreciated having Carlin on the bench right now.
Arianne DeVogue, Supreme Court reporter for CNN. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, a janitor at a border detention center rescues migrants' belongings that were thrown in the trash, like toothbrushes, water bottles, letters, and he turns them into art. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt. 20 red and blue used toothbrushes lined up in a row. Love letters saying, "I will be yours forever." Mixed CDs. All items belonging to migrants who crossed the border from Mexico into America and then were arrested by Border Patrol. Most of the items they brought with them were thrown away by Border Patrol agents. But they were rescued by a janitor who worked at the Border Protection Facility near Ajo, Arizona. And now photos of these items that he took are at the Skirball Cultural Center in a new exhibition. Joining me to talk about these photos is Makita Easter. She's a writer for the LA Times. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So first of all, these are just regular items that the migrants brought with them, right? They're just everyday household items that you wouldn't really look at twice. But when you see them arranged in a display for a photograph, they look different. They take on some kind of meaning, right?
Right. Yeah. These are all kinds of items. I mean, medications from insulin to pain relief medication, to jewelry, little trinkets, blankets, even kind of dirty rubber duckies that were used to mark the path crossing the border. All types of items that Border Patrol deemed potentially lethal or non-essential that were thrown out.
Including toothbrushes.
Yeah, including toothbrushes.
So this janitor who's working at this facility in Arizona, he thinks, oh, there's something meaningful here. I want to collect these. So he just fished them out of the garbage?
Yeah, it's actually kind of, there's a backstory to it. So Tom Kiefer, the photographer, he lived in Los Angeles.
And he's the janitor.
Yeah, he is a janitor. He moved to Ajo, Arizona. He had worked as a graphic designer and owned an antique store. He moved to Ajo, Arizona to just kind of get away from it all and buy a house and to focus on his art. And so he took this job part-time as a janitor to help supplement. He was photographing like cultural landscapes at the time. And at first, I think for the first 2 years, agents would collect food out of the trash and donate them to local food bank in Arizona. And then under new leadership, they were told that they couldn't donate the food anymore. And so that went on for 2 more years where he wasn't able to donate the food. And then at one point he asked for permission, can I donate this food again? And when he was looking for the food, that's when he came into contact with the other items, the personal belongings and all that. And he said his first initial response wasn't to photograph these things. It was just to take them out of the trash. He saw toothbrushes, Bibles, rosaries, and he just felt compelled to pull them from the trash. And he said he didn't feel anyone would believe that these things were being thrown out unless he had taken them. And so from there, it took a whole 6 years of collecting before he took his first photograph of some items.
Why did he think it was necessary to pull these items out of the trash?
Yeah, I think he just felt some kind of inner compulsion that this didn't feel right to him. And so and he said that he didn't think anyone would believe the things that he had seen. So he just took them and stored them in his house. So he doesn't really know why exactly he took them out. But at the time, it wasn't to make art from it. It was just, I have to pull these things out of the trash.
So if he did this for years, he must have had hundreds, if not thousands, of these items.
Yeah, he estimates that he has over 100,000 items, not just in his house, but stored in other places around Ajo, Arizona. And 90% of it hasn't been photographed. So he thinks this is going to be a project that he does for the rest of his life. He told me that he's still trying to figure out how to photograph some of the things. Like he said, underwear was one that he was not sure, but he wants to photograph. So it's going to take a while to go through all this stuff.
And what's his process for taking the photograph? How does he arrange the items?
Yeah, I think he said he has 2 ladders and kind of some some wood or like a metal piece connecting the two ladders, and he attaches his camera on it so he can like, because there's a mix in the Skirball exhibit, there's some very large photographs and then there's the smalls, which are like individual portraits that are like just one item. But the large, I think he uses this ladder setup to photograph them. And he said his camera is like a, I don't remember the exact model, but it was like a used camera that he bought for the project.
And he puts them on a colorful background.
Yeah, he has, there's a mix of colorful backgrounds. There's one photo that is like on top of grass, like a little grass setup. But most of the photos pop with color. And that was intentional because he wanted to find a way to humanize these objects so that the someone looking at the picture isn't just looking at a shoe. The color, he says it just draws people in. And the curator at the Skirball, Laura March, she said that the color is, once you know the backstory and you're kind of drawn to these photos through the color and the composition, once you know the backstory, it's kind of like a knife to the gut is how she described it. And I think from afar, you just think, oh, this looks cool. These toothbrushes look cool. They're colorful. But then when you read that they were taken from people, thrown away, then it just has this really powerful and sad backstory.
It also made me think of, well, at the Holocaust Museum in D.C., there's an exhibit of lots and lots of shoes from Holocaust victims. And I wonder if that's sort of the similar impetus for this photographer. Granted, none of the people here were killed or sent to gas chambers, but was he thinking that this is a sort of a similar experience?
I think he noted the similarities between, even I got a letter from a reader who said that the photo series reminded him of working, I think seeing documents from Japanese internment camps here. And it was just like a lot of items like this. And so he did this between 2003 and 2014. So it was during the Bush and Obama eras, which I think is kind of important to note because a lot of the responses I've been seeing to the story immediately like kind of tie it to the Trump administration. And I mean, that's a good parallel, but he did this work before. And so it's kind of showing the through line from Republican and Democratic parties that this has been happening and is happening currently.
And so you say he collects these items. He has them in his house and other places in Ajo, Arizona.
Right.
Does he have plans for them?
So he's going to photograph them for a while, but I think in the long term, he wants to donate them to an institution or university as kind of a document of how migrants and asylum seekers have been treated in this country. And I don't know when he plans to do that. But I know he will be photographing for a while, and ultimately that's the goal.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Makita Easter. She's an LA Times journalist, and she wrote about Tom Kiefer's exhibition. It's called El Sueño Americano, The American Dream, and it's at the Skirball Center. Coming up, how 1 year changed San Francisco, including the emergence of the punk band, the Dead Kennedys.
Jerry Brown was to the Dead Kennedys. He was the symbol of all that had gone wrong with hippies.
How 1978 created the modern San Francisco. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. San Francisco, a booming tech metropolis with some of the highest housing costs in the country. It has a thriving art scene. It was the birthplace of the United Nations, the center of the 1960s counterculture, a leader in gay rights. Well, author and longtime San Francisco watcher Lincoln Mitchell argues that the city of today actually began in 1978 when two political leaders were assassinated. The hometown baseball Giants had a breakout year that unified the city, and punk rock emerged as a political force. Also, Prop 13, it shaped the state's political and financial future for the rest of the century and beyond. Lincoln Mitchell joins me now. He tells the story in his new book called San Francisco Year Zero. Hi.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Take me back to when you were growing up in San Francisco and your memories of 1978. How old were you?
I turned 11 in December of 1978. So I was 10 years old that whole year, basically. And my mother had moved out there in 1971, and we were part of the newer San Francisco. We were, you know, a left-wing Jewish family from New York. We were part of that movement of hippies and gays and others who came to San Francisco because of what it had become in the late 60s and the 1970s. And there was a conflict, not always, you know, violent, but it became violent between those people and their political representatives and the older San Franciscans that didn't like the changes that were happening in their city. And that was a big part of San Francisco in 1978 for me. That was implicit. And the other big part was I went to a lot of Giants games, and the Giants almost were in first place most of the summer and then lost a close pennant race to the Dodgers, which was probably much better news for your listeners than it was for me and my friends.
Definitely. Well, 1978 was not just a pivotal year for you and the Giants. It was a pivotal year politically and for the city. This was the year, of course, when Harvey Milk and George Moscone were assassinated by Dan White. Talk about that, about how earth-shattering that event was for San Francisco.
Well, to really understand how earth-shattering that event was, and those assassinations occurred on November 27th of 1978, you have to go back 2 weeks earlier, more or less, and as the unraveling of the Jonestown occurred, leading to the mass murder of about 800 people there. And many of those people had roots in San Francisco. Jim Jones had been a political figure and a preacher whose headquarters, before moving to Jonestown, had been in San Francisco. And when that happened, it was a shock, I think globally, but it was a real shock in San Francisco. And that really shook up the city, and the city was reeling. And Mayor Moscone, in his last days in office, spent a lot of time trying to help the city through this terrible crisis. And then, you know, 12 days more or less after that happened, a little less actually, Dan White assassinated George Moscone and Harvey Milk. And that was an enormous blow in just the shock. Are we going to survive this? And there were many people who didn't think San Francisco would survive this, and many on the right who wasted no time in blaming both of these events on the excesses of the 1960s, despite the fact that Jim Jones was, you know, an older guy from the Midwest who didn't really have roots in San Francisco and never really embraced the 1960s. And Dan White was a right winger. He was not some wide-eyed radical lefty who went nuts. He was a right winger who killed the two most visible progressive leaders in the city. And that meant it had a political impact as well, because it really just devastated the political leadership, the progressive leadership in the city.
Right. And the woman who had become a United States Senator, Dianne Feinstein, she had to announce to the city what had happened.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Jesus Christ!
The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
So she was the Board of Supervisors president at the time. She became the acting mayor and then would go on to become, of course, Senator Dianne Feinstein. Her career was really sealed in that moment.
Yes, her career was made in that moment. And we can say that kind of offhandedly, but she played an extraordinary role in San Francisco. Dianne Feinstein was not a, you know, she was liked, but she wasn't beloved. She'd run for mayor in 75 against George Moscone and came in third, didn't make the runoff. She'd announced the morning of the assassinations in City Hall that she was basically, to the press corps, essentially that she was retiring from politics because she could see that her political fortunes were going to change had Moscone survived. But she really held the city together, and she was very, very strong at that moment and really demonstrated what an extraordinary person and what an extraordinary politician she was. But she also began the process of trying to heal the wounds that had torn the city apart. That fight that I alluded to earlier between the older, kind of angrier, reactionary San Francisco and the new progressive one. And Dianne Feinstein tried to bring that together, tried to split that difference. We're going to be pro-business, we're going to be pro-real estate, but we're also going to be tolerant, and we're not going to allow bigotry and racism and homophobia to be part of the culture of San Francisco. And Moscone had started that second part, but she saw it through because he wasn't around.
So that's the politics end of it. You're saying that politically, the assassinations of Moscone and Milk really paved the way for the modern San Francisco that we have today. What about on the cultural side? You make an argument for punk rock in San Francisco. And I must confess, one doesn't normally associate San Francisco with punk rock. One associates it with London, New York, and Los Angeles. But anyway, go ahead, make your case.
Well, San Francisco's punk rock scene was really very different. By 1978, The Summer of Love, a charitable way to describe the music of it, had grown stale. But the reason the San Francisco punk scene is different is, unlike L.A., New York, or London, or elsewhere, it was much more explicitly political. And I'll just give a few examples of that. One is just the lyrics of I'm not going to start quoting all the lyrics here, but the bands like the Avengers, the Dead Kennedys, Code of Honor, really took on the rightward shift, also continuing into the early 1980s, of the United States. But in spring of 1978, there was a big coal mining strike in West Virginia and Ohio, and that part of the country, you know, where we have coal mines. And a bunch of punk bands did a fundraiser in San Francisco. And then the second example I would give is in the fall of 1978, you had mentioned Proposition 13, but the other major statewide initiative that year, which mercifully failed and was defeated, was Proposition 6, which was a very homophobic proposition, which would have made it possible to fire any school teacher in the state of California who was gay. And the punks held a fundraiser to raise money to defeat Proposition 6. The fundraiser was called Nicks on 6, and the MC of that fundraiser was Harvey Milk. It was a month or two before, you know, the last month or two of his life. And that's the kind of crossover between politics and punk rock that you don't see in other cities, and that culminates, really, in 1979, when Jello Biafra, the frontman for the Dead Kennedys, ran for mayor against Dianne Feinstein as the only person challenging her from the left, because the previous progressive leadership had literally been killed.
Well, you mentioned Jello Biafra, and so we would be remiss if we didn't play a little clip from the Dead Kennedys' California Uberalls.
I am Governor Jerry Brown. My aura smiles and never frowns. Soon I will be president. Out of power, I'll sweep the way. I will be Führer one day. I will command all of you. If it's a
So it's kind of a funny song, Your Kids Will Meditate in School, basically making fun of Jerry Brown being into kind of Buddhism and that kind of thing.
And Jerry Brown was, to the Dead Kennedys, he was the symbol of all that had gone wrong with hippies. And that anyone in 1978, I mean, he continued to be governor, you know, through 2018, but or not, you know, on and off, obviously. But that Jerry Brown was the symbol of the fascist takeover, you know, California Uberalis of California, is implausible. And they actually wrote a song a few years later updating it about what was then President Reagan. I'm your President Ronald Reagan, born again with fascist craven. But it shows that tension between the punks and the people about half a generation older who really saw Jerry Brown and meditating in school and things like your aura as really important. And the punks were pushing back against that.
Okay. So on to your third pillar, and that is the San Francisco Giants. And in the 70s, they were pretty bad, right? And they were on the verge of leaving the city?
In January of 1976, they were gone, and they had basically moved to Toronto. And Mayor Moscone, this happened in Mayor Moscone's first days on the job. And the first thing this progressive mayor who'd run on this ambitious progressive platform had to do was find a way to save the Giants, and he did with the help of a wealthy businessman named Bob Lurie. But by 78, spring training, there were talks of them leaving again because the attendance was so bad, the team was so bad, there was no excitement, the ballpark was terrible. And then in 1978, they had their first good year significantly since they'd gotten rid of Willie Mays, so it was kind of a new, younger team. It really kind of galvanized us and made us fall in love with the Giants in a way that had not happened before. And that helped keep the Giants in San Francisco. And that's significant because if you had Jonestown and then the assassinations and then the Giants leaving, the recovery of San Francisco would have been much, much more difficult.
So how does all of this tie into the San Francisco we see today?
Well, the reason this feeds into San Francisco today, or helps explain San Francisco today, is that San Francisco is a complicated, sometimes paradoxical city. It is, in fact, extremely expensive, with extremely expensive housing. But on the other hand, it has a genuinely progressive political tradition. It is both extremely pro-business, real estate is very, very powerful there, and it is also very tolerant and very diverse and embraces and celebrates that diversity. And that's the hybrid that came out of 1978, and that became the framework for governing San Francisco, and that leads us to the San Francisco of today.
But the way that you describe it, that sounds like a paradise, right? I mean, everyone gets a little bit of what they want. There's peace. Well, there aren't political assassinations. But a lot of people are unhappy with the way San Francisco is today.
Well, I would say that compromise doesn't always lead to paradise, right? And not having political assassinations is a relatively low bar,
yeah.
Right? I'm not making the claim that San Francisco is paradise, right? But what I am making the claim is that to understand it, this compromise led to that. And all compromises are imperfect.
Well, one of the big problems in San Francisco right now, in fact, in a lot of big cities, including here in LA, is the incredibly high price of real estate that people can't afford to live in the city. And that is also a function of another big thing that happened in 1978, and that was the passage of Prop 13. So how did that figure into your thesis?
Prop 13 was extremely important. I'm glad you brought it up because non-California media often doesn't realize how important Proposition 13 was. And in fact, George Moscone, who campaigned very actively against Proposition 13, as many mayors did for obvious reasons, and Proposition 13, just so in case everyone doesn't know, froze property taxes, which made it very difficult for local governments to generate enough revenue. And that's something with which many local governments in California, including Los Angeles and San Francisco, wrestle today. So one of the ways that figures into my thesis for the book is that this was another thing that happened in 1978 that changed San Francisco, and in fact, all of California forever, but that also limited the bandwidth for governing. You were never going to be able to raise the money and craft policy that allowed you to pursue some of the progressive goals of a Moscone or a Harvey Milk at that time, who supported Moscone and the Board of Supervisors.
Well, it is a fascinating thesis, and thank you very much for coming on the show to talk about it.
Been a pleasure.
Lincoln Mitchell, author of the new book, San Francisco, Year Zero. Coming up, whatever happened to the paparazzi? Instagram, that's what. How celebrity gossip changed in the last 10 years. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Paris Hilton, Lindsay Lohan, Britney Spears. In the early 2000s, these women's lives, especially the most unflattering parts, were a tabloid obsession. Almost every week, we saw them on the covers of Us, In Touch, Star, and other magazines. But in 2010, Instagram came along and changed all of that. The paparazzi were no longer our only entry into the sordid lives of celebrities. The celebrities now had control, and they gave us a new way to interact with them and eventually to market themselves. Joining me now to talk about this is Amanda Hess, critic at large at the New York Times. And she wrote about how Instagram killed the tabloid celebrity as part of the paper's recap of the last decade in culture. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's go back to the early 2000s and revisit the paparazzi world back then. What was it like?
It was gross. It was this conflict-oriented, deeply misogynistic kind of ritual, I think, that was unfolding between the paparazzi and celebrities. And everyone was sort of stuck together in this kind of self-loathing circuit where celebrities would exit their cars and try to make it into a club or vice versa. And the paparazzi would scramble to try to get a photo of them. And often the photos were extremely unflattering. There was something called an upskirt photo, which you don't really see much of anymore, but where the paparazzo would crouch on the ground to try to get a photo up a female celebrity's skirt as she exited a car. It was just extremely gross.
Yeah, but we all fed off that. Like, we all wanted to see those pictures.
Yeah, it really defined, you know, what I thought of as a female celebrity when I was in high school and college. And in a way, it glamorized this kind of misogynistic train wreck image of how we should treat women and what a woman should be.
Hmm. And then the celebrity takes back the reins with Instagram.
Yes. So all of a sudden, the paparazzi photographer was not needed anymore for us to see even more intimate images of these people. We were inside their cars. We weren't just waiting outside with the paparazzi to take a photo of them when they left the car. We were inside their kitchens. We were inside their bathrooms. the photos were often like semi-nude or scandalous, so we weren't missing out on that either. But it was the celebrity or their team who they had hired to take these photos who was controlling now this feed of images. And that reversed this relationship that we had with the celebrities, where all of a sudden, instead of this antagonistic relationship, it was this kind of conspiring relationship, and we became a part of their own publicity machine.
So what happened to the paparazzi?
I mean, they're still around, so TMZ still exists. But honestly, if you look in Us Weekly today, as opposed to 10 or 15 years ago, you see a lot of Instagram photos that the celebrities have posted themselves, and B, celebrity drama that is based within the world of Instagram. So Selena Gomez unfollowed Bella Hadid. This is like the kind of storyline that we have to become interested in.
The scandal of the du jour.
Yeah. And it's all, again, it's much more controlled by the celebrity themselves.
But celebrities are still doing bad things or making questionable decisions. They're still getting wasted and going to clubs. So why aren't we seeing those photos?
I think there's less of a market. And you can see celebrities themselves posting inappropriate photos to their own feeds, and that can kind of satiate everyone, I think, for that. But I think it's notable that some of the most famous and followed people are the Kardashians, and Kim Kardashian does not drink. And the way that I think about it is a kind of domestication of the wild female celebrity that we used to see going into these clubs. Now we see them sober, but still highly feminized. So Kim Kardashian's look is all about her sexuality, but also her motherhood entwined together. And to me, even though this is an image that's controlled by the woman herself, there's something insidious about it too, because it promotes this need for extreme control over a woman's image, down to like the photoshopped intricate and extreme makeup practices that many of these Instagram celebrities employ. And because our relationship to Instagram is so different than it was to the tabloids, all of these things are being sold to us in a very explicit way.
Well, it's really interesting that this extreme control that you talk about, you're saying, is basically a reaction to the out of control lives that their predecessors lived, the Paris Hiltons, the Lindsay Lohans, the Britney Spears, that now we're in an era of extreme control. Which, from your perspective as a feminist writer, is worse?
I think they're different. When paparazzi were taking these horrific images of women, it was openly and obviously misogynistic. I think it was easy to identify, and the hatred of women was very easy to identify in those images. Now we see images that feel nice and not coming from a place of hate, but that are so wrapped up in this economy that's around perfecting women's images that they do in some way point to discomfort with the way that women look and this need for women to expertly control and maintain their bodies in a way that I think can be more insidious because on the surface it isn't so glaringly misogynistic.
And so the consumption of these images is being done by women too.
There's this presence that it has in female culture, in women's lives, that I think is exaggerated, even if most of the men I know are also on Instagram along with me. It has a different kind of role and weight for women.
Yeah, but to be honest, women were the ones buying In Touch and Us Weekly and People magazine and all those.
Yes, of
too,
course.
Back in the
of
day.
Course. Yeah, I don't think that that aspect of it has changed. I think one of the most confusing aspects of this time of celebrity that peaked in the early 2000s was the fact that the consumers of that stuff was always women. And I do think there's this way in which celebrities, they don't just represent our ideal, right? They also, I think, channel our fears. I like to think that maybe the positive thing is that if these celebrity women represented our fears, they represented this out of control, wild thing that women, you know, didn't want to become. And now if they represent this hyper-controlled domestic feminine, that is a little bit taboo now, actually. And so there's this way that they represent the mirror of our ideal, too. And so if that's true, then I think that's a good thing.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Amanda Hess is critic at large at The New York Times. All right, that'll do it for us here at Press Play. You can download or subscribe to our podcast whenever you want, so you can listen whenever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.